Support for 51% comes from the Master of Arts in Teaching program at Bard College, offering master's degrees and teacher certification in 1 year, graduate study and extensive public school residencies combined with small class sizes, and a focus on the learner as an individual. Now accepting applications, teaching what matters, bard.edu/mat/ny.
On this week's 51%, we hear from a writer traveling to Armenia to empower women artists.
I'm reconnecting these women to a bookmaking practice that has long been cherished by Armenians, but was really lost at the time of the genocide.
A new exhibit highlights the author of what many consider to be the first science fiction novel, and a mother tells a birth story. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Susie Banks-Baum is a writer, artist, teacher, and community organizer who resides in the Berkshires region of Massachusetts. She has embarked on her second trip to Gyumri, Armenia. Her first visit in March sparked the idea for New Illuminations, a three-part project for November in Armenia that includes research and interviews, a workshop, and exhibition. The project aims to revive the historic art of hand-bound books by introducing new tools of expression to a select group of Armenian women artists over a four-day workshop, using the book as both an art form and women's rights tool. I caught up with Banks-Baum before she left on her trip and asked about her connection to Armenia.
The connection really was born from my desire to connect with women internationally, women for whom the creative practice is in some way more challenging than what women here in the United States experience. I'm a writer and an artist and a teacher. I build books by hand using an old method of Coptic stitch journals, which is a painting process basically in which you prepare papers for a book and then sew bookboard together and create a beautiful handmade book. And I'm really interested. I think the core of my work is about the threshold to creative practice and the challenges that people experience clearing that threshold. So in my work here in the United States, I teach locally in my community. I teach at writing conferences, mostly with women. I have a free program that I do at my library. And what I have found that is that here in the United States, women experience a vast array of reasons why they don't engage in whatever creative pursuit it is that they dream about. And there are many social structures, among which, of course, is our work and making a living and supporting our families, being in partnership, all of those sort of social structures. But also, there's a really great amount of expectation when you begin to think about being creative. So many of us heard as young girls, you know, don't sing so loudly in the choir, or maybe you're really not meant to be an artist. And those early messages that we got in third and fourth grade from well-meaning but busy and perhaps overwhelmed teachers, those messages stay with us. So that no matter how sort of perhaps intellectual our work may be, when we veer towards what we may think of as creative, we think, oh, I'm not creative. And you hear that voice from that teacher back way back when that said, you know, and that damper that is put on women, it's put on many children, but it's very often put on women to sort of put the lid back on. Don't be so loud. Don't be so crazy. Don't be so colorful, so wild. Those early messages really restrict us in our adulthood. And we find it very difficult, I think, to begin a creative practice, something that you yearn to do, like writing. So that's my inquiry. That's my point of intersection in everything that I teach, whether I'm teaching bookmaking or writing. And last March, I traveled to Armenia with one of my colleagues, a man named John Stanmeyer, who many people will know throughout the United States as a cherished photographer for the National Geographic publication. But John is, at his heart, a humanitarian. So I went with John as a visual storyteller, and I traveled with mostly photojournalists. And I executed a plan to interview 25 women artists in the city of Gyumri to understand what their life conditions are like, what social structures are helping or impeding them towards doing the work that they feel called to do in the world. And I wanted to sit in their kitchens or sit in their living rooms or wherever we could visit and just get to know them. I work with many different kinds of women here in the United States, but I know that there are women the world over for whom their artistic pursuits are hampered by much more threatening structures than we experience here in the United States. For instance, most women, Armenian women in Armenia, are expected to marry. They can get a great education. Armenia has among the highest literacy rates in the world. They value education, and children are educated through high school and into college very enthusiastically by their families. But then once a girl emerges with, you know, a bachelor's or a master's degree, she's expected to marry and move into her in-law's home and become part of that family constellation and really have her life absorbed by her husband's family. So any individuating characteristics, in particular her own personal work, have to fit within that family structure. So you can imagine that a woman who is an artist who isn't generating income immediately would be very, her life goals wouldn't be high on the scale of importance in that family dynamic. She's also expected to bear children. So in Armenia, which is a very patriarchal society, in Armenia, the problem of domestic violence is very high. It has one of the highest rates of unreported domestic violence in the world. So there is an undercurrent in women's lives of the gender differences that bears towards violence in many, many homes. I did get to some conversations about that with women. My hope is in returning that there are relationships of trust that I have made with these women that we can move into some of those more sensitive topics. The women that I did speak about were not speaking about so much about violence, but about real gender difference and the expectation that a woman would fulfill her family role first. And if there is some time, energy, and money left for her to pursue her professional aspirations, then they would be dealt with. In most cases, those pursuits are they're left behind in many cases. There are many more men in Armenia in general because by the time a woman's 40, she will, on average, have had 8 abortions in favor of a male child. And that's not information, you know, that's just information that's readily available. The research shows that while fulfilling the expectation to produce a male child in a family, a woman goes through that cycle of pregnancy and loss, pregnancy and loss, pregnancy and loss. And that is a very disheartening life cycle to be in. So those are some of the social impediments, I think, that women, artist or not, deal with in Armenia. There's also the problem of poverty in that country, underemployment. There's very few opportunities for women. And in the smaller cities like Gyumri, where I traveled, women don't drive, and they're much more sort of homebound and isolated.
What separates the women who are able to practice their art from those who aren't?
Perseverance. And many of them have fathers and mothers, but fathers in particular, who support them. So if a woman decides that she wants to pursue a career in the arts, even as a graphic designer, or a fashion designer, something that's not quite so open-ended as being a painter, having a father who is willing to keep her in her family home rather than getting married and moving on, which is the expectation, having that strong father figure seems to be one of the aspects that provides a woman with more opportunity and gives her somewhat of a shelter before going on to get married. And, you know, I sat with married women in their homes. For instance, one woman I interviewed, who I hope is going to be part of this workshop, Ani, she started out wanting to be a fashion designer, and that just that was an aspiration that was quickly dwindled because there just was not opportunity for her to pursue that. So she continued on doing graphic design work, all the while drawing, painting, and nurturing her artistic spirit. And her husband, she's married to a man who is also an artist. He has found more direct success. She has found a job in a restaurant where she makes beautiful meals. So there is some expression of beauty happening in the work that she does in the world. But they also have three children, and they live in a very simple dwelling. Because of the earthquake in 1988, the Soviets at that time delivered thousands of these metal boxes called domiks to to the people in Gyumri and the surrounding area where the earthquake took place. And there are still many people living in these metal boxes. They've added on to them. They've, you know, insulated them. It's like a small trailer, basically, that's been embellished. So Ani and her husband and their three children live with her mother and his father and mother in a very small setting. So there's no room for quiet. The quiet she has really is when she walks between her home and her job at the restaurant. And while she is really dedicated to the work that she has done and that she wants to do, she knows that in order to survive and help her family keep themselves together, she needs to carry on this job. So sitting with a woman like that, from whom I can see physically, I'm in this very small, welcoming and kind and lovely place, she's either at her job or she's with her family. And there's no in-between spot where her own work could emerge.
So while you're there, you'll be teaching a 4-day workshop for 10 women artists on writing and bookmaking.
They will learn the Coptic stitch book form, and we will write. We'll do some beginning creative writing practices, and we'll share some stories. I really see this workshop as a cultural exchange. I'm reconnecting these women to a bookmaking practice that has long been cherished by Armenians, but was really lost at the time of the genocide. There are very few book artists now in Armenia. So that workshop is really rekindling this artistic practice and beginning to seed community there. And then I have 2 weeks of interviews of visiting the same artists I saw before, so I can continue my conversation with them and meeting new women and traveling to some other outlying villages. And then at the end of that week, the exhibit Codex, Illuminating Women's Experience Through Contemporary Manuscripts, that will open with work from that original workshop, collaborating with a woman named Anna Gargarian, who is an art curator in Yerevan. And she produces these pop-up exhibits that have a real cultural application. And the theme really with this workshop, with mine called The New Illuminations, is this idea of cultural preservation in a country that has had so much ruin and so many changes politically, so many earthquakes, genocide, you know, just the chaos reigns in many ways. And the threads of cultural distinction that have carried through all of that, with historic buildings, with these illuminated manuscripts, with textiles, with ceramics, with music, with poetry, these qualities are what make Armenians Armenian. And I'm just hoping to really fan the flames of that and the book arts.
What is your hope? You know, when you're on the plane back to the United States, what do you hope to have accomplished?
Oh, well, I hope with the women that I've worked with before, that I interviewed before, I hope that at least 7 of them will have taken my workshop and let themselves experience making books, and that their really beautiful, lush expression will take form in these books and really impress them and make them into a unique and new illuminated manuscript for Armenia. You know, a new, this more contemporary expression, which includes a woman's voice. So I hope when I'm on that plane, I will have seen a host of new books that are made. And I hope that in my interviews with the women that I know already, that we will be able to speak a little more intimately about their daily lives and where they feel the pressures are for them that keep them from working and what changes they see possible in their life that could be made to promote their work, to have them spend more time on their artistic expression. And I hope that I've continued to build my net of women artists, because I would love to have this project grow and continue building books with new groups of women, continuing with the women that I've already worked with, so that over the next 3 or 4 years, the body of work grows, connects to other Armenian cities, and the Matan Nararan Museum has an exhibit of new women's illuminated manuscripts. That's like, that would be amazing.
That was Susie Banks-Baum, writer, artist, teacher, and community organizer from the Berkshires region of Massachusetts. She was traveling to Armenia to empower women artists through her New Illuminations project. Reporter Kristen Gourlay was expecting a routine childbirth. It was anything but. She went back 3 years to review the medical records from that day and tells this story about the time that changed her life.
July 10, 2013. I've just gotten out of bed. It's about 8 o'clock. I'm getting ready to go to work. My water breaks. Babe?
It's happening?
We get in the car. And then, hun, I'm not going to make it.
You mean?
I can't make it to the hospital in the city. We have to go to the local hospital, fast. This baby is coming now. You want out. You know, everything until now had been normal. Normal tests, normal sonograms,
normal.
By 10 a.m., I lay in a hospital bed trying to push you out.
You can do this.
But you just don't want to descend. I push, you stall. I push, you grow fainter. I push. You seem to be disappearing. That's when they start scrubbing me down, shaving me, prepping for an emergency C-section. I'm on the operating table. I feel a great pressure down on my abdomen. Then a great lightness.
The patient was born on 7/10/13 at 15:01 p.m. via C-section, secondary to failure to descend.
Sudden cold. They pull you out. Then nothing. No screaming baby, no congratulations. I feel like I'm underwater. I can't hear anyone.
At 15:02, the baby was brought out to the resuscitation table and was found to have a heart rate of 110. His color was blue.
You are blue.
There was minimal respiratory effort and no tone.
Where's my baby? What happened to my baby?
You're gone.
Is he okay? I'm an open wound on this table. The room is silent, just the swoosh of lab coats. Voices muffled on the other side of a pane of glass.
CPR was started at 15:04. CPR was continued until
someone comes and whispers in my ear, "Ma'am, your baby's having a little trouble breathing. What?
Infant developed spontaneous respiration and a faint cry was heard around the tube.
What's happening?
The CPR was then stopped at 15:60.
I get to hold you once for a few minutes. He's not stable yet, they say. So they take you in an ambulance to a bigger hospital with a NICU. I'm not allowed to go with you. There's no room for me in the ambulance. No beds open for me in the big hospital. Only 40 minutes away, but so far. I stay alone in a room at the little hospital. I feel like clawing my way out, past the IV pole, past the front desk nurse, out the door, down the road, into the night. Then Grandma arrives.
I burst into the hospital room. Just the look on her face, she was lost because there was something taken away from her, and she didn't know what to do, and neither did I.
They tell me over the phone you're hooked up to monitors, an IV, your blood oxygen dips sometimes, but you're improving. I need to get to you more than I've ever needed anything. I want to rip off my bandages, call a taxi, and speed to you. There's no room, they keep telling me. I'm losing my mind, I say.
We're taking good care of him. He's in good hands.
They're not mine, I say. Then finally, I'm released. Grandma and I race up to the big hospital. I throw open the curtain and...
The moment you first saw Magnus, your precious, precious child who you almost lost...
There's a picture of us, of me seeing you for the first time since they took you away in an ambulance. My face is cracking into sobs. Your little hand, bandaged to an IV, the tiny monitors stuck to your chest. You're finally in my arms.
The calm that came over your face was just ethereal, really.
You're perfect. I'll sleep in the chair by your bassinet. I'm not leaving without you. This piece was produced by Kristen Gourlay as part of the 24-hour radio race from KCRW's Independent Producer Project.
Kristen Gourlay is a reporter for Rhode Island Public Radio. Her son Magnus is now a happy, healthy 3-year-old. A new exhibit at Minneapolis's Bakken Museum explores the genius behind Frankenstein, the 1818 novel written by a teenage girl, Mary Shelley. It's a story that continues to resonate, even after the Halloween candy goes stale. KFAI's Will Wright reports.
Enter the new Mary and Her Monster exhibit at Minneapolis's Bakken Museum, and it may startle you, as it did me.
You were completely startled. Seeing that movement just completely disturbed you. the way you jumped was great.
My being startled made the Bakken's curator, Juliette Burba, giddy. What fooled me was a portrait of Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein, the 1818 novel that shook the world, and still does. For more than a decade, the Bakken Museum showed its Frankenstein laboratory. Now it's commemorating the author, the teenage girl who wrote the first science fiction novel, beginning it all. Why do this exhibit now at the Bakken Museum? I mean, you already have the Frankenstein's laboratory.
There's a couple of reasons to do it now. We are on the 200-year anniversary of when Frankenstein was written. And so Mary Shelley began it in the summer of 1816, and then it was published in 1818. So we, in essence, have 2 years now to celebrate the bicentennial. But also, we've had this very popular exhibit, the Frankenstein Object Theater, that tells the story. But we wanted to tell the story of the woman behind that story. She was 18 when she started writing Frankenstein. And so it's a fascinating story when you think about an 18-year-old in 1816 writing this story that we still use as a metaphor.
Why not let the portrait describe how Mary began? Just imagine a large wall photo turning toward and talking to you.
The weather was terrible and we spent many hours inside talking. We also read ghost stories. One evening Lord Byron said each of us should write our own ghost story. I busied myself thinking of a story to rival the ones we had been reading. Could I make a reader like you dread to look around? Perhaps a corpse could be reanimated using electricity.
Why come to an exhibit about the teenager that wrote the first science fiction novel?
I think it might be the chance to figure out, you can take some quizzes, some interactive quizzes, and you can figure out how you might relate to aspects of Mary's personality.
How about the creatures?
You know, we didn't explore that, but certainly after you've explored her world, you can go next door and hear that story in the Object Theater.
Referring to Frankenstein's laboratory at the Bakken.
Now that I had finished, the beauty of the dream vanished, and breathless horror and disgust filled my heart.
We'll be reopening that because these two exhibits will work so nicely together.
The best-known clips of the monster have a being that speaks in grunts. One facet of Mary and Her Monster has examples of books that the former read. The book gives us a creature that, while grotesque, is articulate and well-read. About these books...
If you look at the list of books that she read just around the time that she was working on this, you can see she read immense amounts of literature. She read books on science, poetry, history. And so in a way, the monster reflects her.
Which raises an interesting, perhaps prickly question of to what extent was it an alter ego for her?
I know that scholars have proposed that is indeed the case, that she saw it in that way. Perhaps it is in part an alter ego for her.
Each of us likes a great scare, ideally on our own terms. This exhibit shows that Mary created a universal emblem of the other, her monster, that affected generations, and still does. This is Will Wright for KFAI.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. The show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1425.